Made possible by Midas Auto Service Center, 304 West University Avenue at Urbana, offering complete car maintenance, scheduled maintenance, and repair service, including a nationwide warranty by ASE-certified technicians. Located near the U of I campus with shuttle service available. More information is available at 367-0300.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from Radio Maria in downtown Champaign, with an international brunch, lunch, and dinner menu influenced by Caribbean, Asian, Indian, Spanish, and Latin cuisines. Radio Maria now features Sunday dinner with a different and unique menu every week.
This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL AM 580. I'm Tom Rogers in for Celeste Quinn. What we know about our federal government mainly comes from the people that are sent to watch the White House and Congress and the rest of Washington, D.C. by newspapers and broadcasters and other media. In his book called Reporting from Washington, The History of the Washington Press Corps, the Associate Historian of the U.S. Senate, Donald Ritchie, chronicles the history of all those men and women over the past 75 years who have been in Washington and the changes that have come to the press corps and the media over that time, as well as how it's grown into what Ritchie and others call an unofficial fourth branch of government. It's that important. Donald Ritchie is our guest in this hour of the Afternoon Magazine, joining us from Washington, D.C., and you can join in on the conversation. You can give us a call with your questions for Donald Ritchie at 333-9455 in Champaign-Urbana or outside the local calling area at 1-800-222-9455. 333-WILL, 1-800-222-WILL. And if the name Donald Ritchie sounds familiar, he's also a commentator, frequent guest on C-SPAN. Many of the C-SPAN programs feature Donald Ritchie as well. He joins us, as mentioned, from Washington. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
And thanks for joining us today. How, as the historian in the Senate, did your attention come toward talking about the people who cover the Senate and other places in D.C.?
Well, I've worked for the U.S. Senate now since 1976, and I don't think there's been a day in that whole time that some reporter hasn't called with a question. And we provide information about the institution, what goes on. And I just got very curious about the people who were reporting on Congress and how accurate the information was that they were putting out and how they went about doing their business. And so I've really been interviewing them as they've been interviewing me over the years.
Yet you've done a lot of research on reporters from as far back as the beginnings of the Franklin Delano Roosevelt administration, which I would guess is maybe relatively difficult. We can talk about historic figures. There's a lot written about them, but not much written about the reporters who do the writing.
Not so much written about them, but they certainly did a lot of writing themselves, and many of them wrote their memoirs or wrote accounts of the people that they covered. I'm a great fan of used bookstores, and I've put together a great collection of books by journalists about politics and about Washington, and gleaned a lot of insights from those books.
The press corps in the 20s and 30s was a lot different from what we see it now, although you know there are some similarities, and a lot of the same questions that people have about the Washington media were talked about then, too.
Mm-hmm. Well, for one, it was a newspaper press corps almost exclusively in 1932. Radio had come around in the 1920s. But as far as news was concerned, it was still a very small media, and it was actually shut out by the newspapers for a very long time. So when Franklin Roosevelt came to office, it was mostly newspaper reporters that he was dealing with. And he actually was a big boon for the Washington Press Corps because the Depression had caused a lot of newspaper companies to fire reporters or put them on half-time salaries. And when Roosevelt came to town, he made Washington such a center of attention that all of a sudden the news bureaus started to hire people, and they needed more people to cover both Franklin and Eleanor Roosevelt.
What was the press corps like before then? Because you used the New Deal as the start of your book, but before that there obviously were reporters in D.C.
That's right. Earlier I wrote a book called Press Gallery, Washington, the Congress and the Washington Correspondents, and there had been reporters in Washington going all the way back to Thomas Jefferson's presidency. So it was nothing new, but it was a relatively small group of reporters. And, of course, just newspaper reporters for the most part. By the 1920s, it was a fairly conservative group of reporters. They were pretty much in sync with the Harding and the Coolidge. And the Hoover administration at first, although Herbert Hoover wound up alienating most of the correspondents during his presidency, but they changed their politics and their inclination very dramatically, I think, when Franklin Roosevelt came in, that the Depression, and then particularly the bonus riots of 1932 had a big impact. I open my book with the reporters out in the middle of Pennsylvania Avenue with the bonus rioters on one side of them and the U.S. Army on the other side, and they really become war correspondents in Washington, D.C. It had a pretty radicalizing effect on many of those reporters.
And Washington back then, we may think of Washington now as a staid place, but in the 20s and before, it was certainly a lot different than what happened once the Roosevelt administration came in.
Until 1932, it was tough for some of the big newspapers to get really credible help in Washington. The New York Times had to practically beg one of their top staff people to come down to run the Washington Bureau. And Walter Trohan, who worked for the Chicago Tribune, he claimed that when he got to Washington, D.C., he could stand in the middle of any of the big broad avenues and read a newspaper and never get run down, that it was such a sleepy town by comparison to Chicago.
And you do mention in the book a lot of reporters turned down the chance to report in D.C., which seems unthinkable today.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and Roosevelt really put Washington in the center of the map for the news industry. Before 1932, New York City was probably the premier place for anybody who was an ambitious reporter. And because New York retained a lot of that with the media when the radio broadcasting and New York television broadcasting as well. But there's been this great competition over the last half century or so between Washington and New York. And Washington, I think, because of the international issues that it's covering and the great national issues, has really wrestled the control, in a sense, of the news away from New York.
What was it like, and sort of gleaning from some of the information you've gotten from some of the reporters' memoirs and the like, what would it have been like to be a newspaper reporter back at that time in the 1930s? As opposed to now, what kinds of pressures, you write quite a bit about the outside pressures, the pressures from above at the newspapers on what and how reporters wrote?
There were good and bad sides to it. You know, and I talk to current reporters and I tell them what it was like for a Washington reporter in the 1930s. Tears come to their eyes because in 1932 and 1933 onwards, Franklin Roosevelt held a press conference twice a week in the Oval Office. As many reporters who could squeeze in got in there, they could ask any questions they wanted. Roosevelt would bandy back and forth with them about it. Today, there's nowhere near that kind of access in the White House, which is much more controlled.
When did that change?
Oh, it changed over time. Probably television had a huge impact in it, starting with Eisenhower and then with Kennedy, that the press conferences, in a sense, became televised stage productions. And a lot of the old-time reporters said that the last president who really actually generated news in the give and take with reporters was probably Harry Truman. So it began to change pretty dramatically in the 1950s, and it's gotten worse and worse in a sense so far as the reporters are concerned. President George W. Bush, for instance, holds fewer press conferences than his father did, and each presidential administration seems to have less direct contact with the media, more sort of backstage manipulation, perhaps, of the press.
So it's been a combination of technology and the individual president himself who makes
those changes. Oh, that's true. It has had a very strong impact in terms of how comfortable different presidents have felt with the press. In the period that I was looking at, Franklin Roosevelt and John Kennedy probably had the best relations with the press, felt the most comfortable with them. Kennedy himself had once been a reporter in 1945 for the Hearst newspapers, and one in Chicago in particular, and he did pretty good at the job, except that he wanted to be a participant, not an observer to events, and so he ran for Congress in 1946. By contrast, Richard Nixon really hated the press. You know, honestly, sincerely disliked reporters and made it very difficult for people to cover him. Even though I found that many reporters respected him, he wasn't a kind of easy man to like if you were trying to cover him.
I'll take your comment about your reference to the Hearst newspapers is sort of the foundation for the next question. As mentioned earlier, a lot of reporters were under a great deal of pressure from their publishers to write in specific ways. And you make also specific reference to Colonel McCormick at the Tribune, another you know, man of a bygone era, I guess.
Yes, well, I was trying to get a grip on the 1930s. I found a poll that was taken of Washington correspondents in 1936, and they were asked which was the most fair and reliable newspaper and which was the least fair and reliable newspaper. The New York Times came out easily the most fair and reliable. The Hearst papers in general came out at the bottom of the list. The single newspaper that was identified was the Chicago Tribune. And so I use that as the basis, the Chicago Tribune versus the New York Times, to look at the media in the 1930s. And what I found as I was going through it was that both the newspapers put up some really first-rate reporters. The Chicago Tribune actually had some outstanding reporters in Washington. It wasn't their reporting that made the newspaper, you know, criticized. It was their publisher who insisted that his reporters hew to the editorial line. And I quote from Willard Edwards, who was a longtime correspondent from the Chicago Tribune, that when he arrived in Washington, he had never bothered to have read the editorial page in the Chicago Tribune. He didn't need it as a police reporter in Chicago. But he interviewed a senator, and Colonel McCormick didn't like the senator he was interviewing and sent a scathing telegram to the bureau. And after that, Edwards realized that he had to read the editorial pages and know who was on the good side and who was on the bad side of his publisher.
Another thing that struck me in the 30s is the difference with which people saw communism back then. One of the people that you profile quite a bit is Lawrence Todd, who was the Washington correspondent for TASS, the Soviet news agency, which, you know, the latitude he had in that time was almost unthinkable, you know, 10, 15 years later.
I found him one of the most fascinating people. You know, many of the correspondents I was dealing with were very famous names like Drew Pearson or Walter Lippmann, sort of household names. Mm-hmm. But Lawrence Todd was somebody I'd never heard of before, but I kept running into him wherever I was investigating. And he turned out to be very good friends with both liberal reporters and conservative reporters. He was an American from Michigan who for many years, from the 1920s to the 1950s, was the Washington correspondent for TASS, which was the Soviet news agency. Later in the 1950s, he was called up before a variety of congressional committees that wanted to know if he'd ever been a member of the Communist Party. And the irony was that TASS wouldn't allow any of its correspondents to belong to any political party. So he could very honestly say, no, he'd never been a communist, he'd never gone to a communist meeting. In fact, TASS didn't really want him to write ideological news. They wanted him to write straightforward factual information. They could put the spin on it when the story got back to Moscow. But he put a lot of politicians in very uncomfortable positions because when the Secretary of State would go off the record, there would be the TASS correspondent sitting in the front row making notes on what was going on. And so he had a remarkable access. He was protected in part by the State Department because they felt that as long as they gave the Soviet agents some space in the press room, then American reporters would have a chance to get into Moscow and to other Soviet bloc countries.
And among other reporters, he was a colleague.
He was extremely well-liked, very scholarly, very diligent in what he was doing. That was quite remarkable for me. At a time that Joe McCarthy was on the floor denouncing communists, here is the TASS reporter sitting right up in the front row in the galleries taking notes on what was going on.
You mentioned the McCarthy hearings, and one of the things you have done in the past is working as the associate historian in the Senate was to take the transcripts of the McCarthy hearings from the 50s and bring them out as well. What kinds of insights in writing this book did you find on that era and on the hearings that didn't come to light? You know, looking at the transcripts of what was actually written down in the Senate.
Well, you know, most everybody who writes about the McCarthy era writes about the people who fought McCarthy and stood up against him. You know, there's a new movie coming out about Edward R. Murrow, and there's some really very dramatic stories, and they still need to be told. But what I got interested in was I discovered that there was a core of Washington correspondents who actually sided with McCarthy, who thought that he was right, who fed him information, who wrote speeches for him, who got inside tips from his committee, and who released it to the public via their newspapers or their radio stations, who were almost guaranteed front page coverage of their stories whenever they had anything they were reporting about Joe McCarthy, and whose careers really soared as long as McCarthy was in the news and was sort of on top of things. But their careers were almost all tugged down by McCarthy's censure. Once people stopped believing in McCarthy, then they stopped believing in the reporters who were on his side. And what I found was that reporters are tried to be objective when they report the news, but there's always this tug towards advocacy. And it's not just liberal advocacy, it's often conservative advocacy. It's both sides, people who feel strongly one way about the issues and who wind up reporting in a certain way that, in a sense, distorts the news or reflects one way of thinking. And morally, sometimes it's the only way to go. You know, in other words, if you really believe that the civil rights movement is in the right, then you're not going to balance your account of what's going on. But advocacy does jeopardize your credibility, and especially if the issue that you're supporting winds up collapsing, then your career can collapse along with it. And that's what happened to quite a few very prominent reporters and radio broadcasters who sided with McCarthy.
And is there any difference today about the pressures of advocacy? From what you've seen, during that era and before, as opposed to what may be going on now?
I think there's always a sort of a tug of war between objectivity and advocacy. The things that keep reporters objective are their editors and their publishers, who are trying to make an objective paper or a broadcast. And also, of course, criticism, letters to the editor, and people who are complaining about bias in the news keeps people sort of in the center as they're writing their stories. But on the other hand, people are always going to feel strongly about particular issues. The rise of Nazism in Germany made people, in a sense, biased against them during the 1930s. And the same thing, as I mentioned, with the civil rights movement. I write about the black press, which essentially made civil rights its primary issue during the 1940s and the 1950s, when the mainstream press, for the most part, was ignoring civil rights issues. And you get this period, the Vietnam War also certainly made people choose sides one way or the other. And it's very hard under those circumstances to maintain pure objectivity. Today we have so many different ways of getting the news out. The Internet is now a major factor in what's going on. And so you get a lot more opinion beginning to filter into what we used to call just straight news. But still, it's a tug of war between the pull to be objective and the pull to take sides.
Your questions are welcome for Donald Ritchie. The book is called Reporting from Washington, The History of the Washington Press Corps. Our numbers are 333-9455 and 1-800-222-9455. And you mentioned, the black journalists have been reporting on Washington had a slight, rather hard time being accepted into the mainstream Washington press corps. And you wrote about that as well, the obstacles that they faced in getting positions in the press corps, at least.
Yes, it's quite ironic that the so-called liberal press actually kept minority reporters out of the galleries for years, and it was really the politicians who opened the galleries up to minorities rather than the reporters themselves. And it's hard to find overt bias in the sense that there were no rules that said that you had to be a white male to report in the galleries. But the reporters wrote rules in such a way that it almost excluded almost all women, and it excluded almost all minorities. And the rules were that you had to report for a daily newspaper, and you had to file your stories by telegraph. And women reporters historically were not doing political news. They were doing social news in Washington, which was of great interest, but they weren't telegraphing their news back to their papers. And black reporters couldn't get jobs in the daily newspapers. They worked for the black press, which is almost exclusively weekly newspapers. So they just couldn't qualify by the rules the way they were written. And I document how during the New Deal period in particular, when what was happening in Washington was having a huge impact on the African-American community, and they wanted to get news reporting on it, black reporters couldn't get into Franklin Roosevelt's press conferences, and they couldn't get into cabinet offices' press conferences or sit in the congressional press galleries. And they lobbied very strongly for a decade or two a fellow named Claude Barnett with the Associated Negro Press, which was based in Chicago, was a great lobbyist in a sense on trying to get black reporters in, and also John Sengstack, who was with the Chicago Defender, and they, in a sense, had two rival news networks that were trying to get black reporters into press conferences. Eventually, the politicians, Roosevelt, his press secretary, Steve Early, and a senator from Illinois by the name of Curly, what was it?
C. Whalen Brooks, isn't
Brooks,
it?
Curly Brooks, yes. Really forced the press galleries to open the doors to the first black reporters. And I tracked their history. Louis Lautier and Alice Dunnigan were the two first black reporters in the galleries. And then Ethel Payne, who reported for the Chicago Defender for many years, came in. And they reported on the news from a different perspective and a different angle, and they asked different questions than the other reporters were asking. They were a very important addition to the press gallery when they got there.
But there still was a pecking order, I guess, as to who got the questions first. And
that's true. You could stand up and raise your hand, but the president had to call on you. And President Eisenhower really didn't want to talk about civil rights for the most part. He thought that it would be better off if the issue remained quiet. And so he discovered that if he ever called on Alice Dunnigan or Ethel Payne, that they were always going to ask him a question about civil rights.
And
he never called on them as a result. So.
And just to make clear that when getting positions in the Washington press corps and into the press gallery, it's the decision of the media themselves and not the decision of anybody at the White House or in Congress to grant those seats.
That's right. It's a remarkable thing. I think Washington is probably the only capital in the world that gives the right to decide who is a journalist to the journalists themselves. And this goes back to 1880 when lobbyists were getting into the press galleries and masquerading as journalists because the politicians would let anybody in who asked to be in the press gallery. Yeah. And so the reporter said, well, we should take over deciding who's really a reporter so we can make sure the only legitimate reporters are here, no lobbyists. And they kept the lobbyists out, but they also kept anybody out who worked for a different form of technology. For instance, radio couldn't get into the newspapers. And today we're having trouble figuring out what to do with the Internet. You know, it doesn't fit the definition that the working journalists have already set.
Right. We'll get to that. And I wanted to get a call in from Eureka, calling us on our toll-free line on line 4. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Quite an interesting discussion. When you talk about bias, I guess you probably get this question over and over again, but and I know it's a large one and there are many different answers, but I guess the question I had is, where does the history of the liberal news media come in terms of its historic emphasis? I really came to, I guess, maturity at the 68 campaign of Nixon and Humphrey, and I think it was bandied about then, but was it more from the conservative elements of the Republican and the Democratic Party? Was it more from like one specific candidate, or what would your view be on its historical derivation?
Well, since the 1930s, most of the polls that have been taken have indicated that more reporters in Washington vote Democratic and see themselves as liberal than others do. But there have always been conservative reporters in Washington. Mm-hmm. The first time that there was a major politician who made a big issue out of the liberal media was Robert Taft. When he was running against Eisenhower for the Republican primary in 1952 for the Republican presidential nomination, and he lost, and he blamed it on the liberal media. Now, it was interesting. He was blaming it on the Republican liberal media, like papers like the New York Herald Tribune and others, that he felt it unfairly attacked him and supported Eisenhower to get Eisenhower nominated by the Republicans and then elected. Richard Nixon picks up on that in 1960, and especially in 1962 when he loses his race in California, mm-hmm. And blames the media for that. It carries on. Newt Gingrich and others have continued those same charges. So there's been a tradition of this. What I found was that prior to 1932, actually most Washington correspondents were Republicans and conservatives. In fact, several of them worked for the Republican National Committee during various elections. But Franklin Roosevelt starts the trend in the opposite direction.
Could I ask a couple short follow-ups?
Mm-hmm. Sure.
In my memory and what I read about the Eisenhower era, though I was quite young when it actually happened, he did not really bring up that philosophical, or that didn't come out much in many of his arguments or speeches or writings, didn't about the liberal news media?
Not Eisenhower, no, because the liberal media was, in a sense, supported him and got him into office. It was Taft who made the complaint.
Uh-huh. And so could you really say that among modern-day politicians, Nixon may have been one of the first ones who made it an intense part of his campaign? Or
yes,
argument?
Very deliberately. And, in fact, after he got into office, he decided to make the whole issue of liberal media a big part of his strategy, and he sent his vice president, Spiro Agnew, to attack the television broadcasting.
Oh, I remember those
particular.
Days well, especially after Cambodia.
That's right, and to undermine public support and belief in the credibility of the news media. You know, Walter Cronkite, for instance, had a big impact on America's thinking about Vietnam mm-hmm. when he came back from Vietnam in 1968 and declared that the war was stalemated and it was quagmire. And Lyndon Johnson supposedly turned to one of his staff members and said that if he'd lost Walter Cronkite, he'd lost America.
Exactly. That's exactly the quote I thought of when you brought that up. Thank you very much.
And thanks for your call. You had mentioned before, Donald Ritchie, the transition that technology has made from, you know, accepting radio as a form of journalism to television to now the internet, and those questions have always persisted over time as to what is a journalist and how the Washington Press Corps determines who gets those passes and who doesn't. Explain a little about how there are some similarities between back when the first radio journalist came out and what we've seen today with you spent a lot of time near the end of the book talking about Matt Drudge and how what kind of impact his column has had and even the latest controversy that sort of brought the process of deciding to light the Jeff Gannon controversy.
Yes. Well, in the 1930s, there was only one press gallery in the Senate and the House, and it was the newspaper press gallery. And any reporter who reported for radio to get a press pass had to also report for a daily newspaper. And many of them did in those days. Radio reporting wasn't full-time, so they would work for a newspaper and then they would work for the radio. There was a fellow named Fulton Lewis Jr., who was a newspaper reporter in Washington, hired by the radio in the late 30s, and when he gave up his newspaper assignment, he lost his press pass. And in those days, radio equipment was pretty heavy, lugging it around. There was no place to sit down, no place to take notes. So he complained to his friends who were serving in Congress, and they created a separate radio gallery. That was a very small gallery because there weren't that many radio reporters in Washington at the time. But from that moment on, you had galleries, the press galleries in Congress, divided up according to the technology by which they reported. There was then a periodical press gallery for magazines, and now newsletters are in there as well. Mm-hmm. And by the 1950s, television came along. Fortunately, the same networks owned the major radio networks owned television networks, so it became a radio TV gallery very quickly. But now you have the Internet, and the question is, well, what is it? Is it a newspaper? Is it a magazine, a newsletter, or is it a broadcast? All of the current press galleries are trying very hard to create rules that will be fair and admit legitimate reporters from the Internet without allowing every 14-year-old with a modem to get a press pass. And that's always been this big question, is who is legitimate and who is not.
Well, is the next step an Internet gallery, perhaps?
Oh, it's quite possible. Now, I do think that the galleries, the standing galleries today, have been much more receptive to the Internet than their predecessors were to radio and to television. But part of that also is because the major news networks all have Internet presence to these days. They're all desperately trying to set up websites to get people to use them because they're afraid that otherwise they'll become obsolete. And so there is a lot more merging of the Internet with the standard media outlets today, and that's helping to some degree to open it up. But still, the definitions are very difficult. One used to be that you had to make a profit by what you had to earn your living by your journalism. Well, mm-hmm. a lot of websites don't produce a lot of money. In fact, they've been losing money for their news networks. And so the profitability side of it is really not a great criteria for making decisions. But now they are focusing on people who exclusively work gathering news, regardless of what type of media that that it's produced on.
And now there's another metamorphosis with bloggers. I mean, and it goes right back to the question you mentioned: how do you admit everybody who has a computer and puts together a column as a member of the press gallery?
It's quite right, and actually there's very limited space in the press galleries. Most of the time now, with C-SPAN and with all the other ways in which you get your news, reporters don't have to show up to use the White House press room or the congressional press galleries. But when they do come, they just overwhelm the facilities. And during the Clinton impeachment trial, it was standing room only in the press gallery. Reporters who work up there told me that when they would stand up from their desk, they'd come back and find somebody sitting down using their phone, even trying to use their internet connections on their computers. And so there really is an effort to try to winnow out the people who are not serious journalists and who don't need to be there on a day-to-day basis. But a lot of reporters from all different types of media do need to have some place to work out of. They need to be on the mailing lists for press conferences. And it's not an easy job to cover the entire federal government, especially if you're working out of a single-person shop or a one- or two-person news bureau.
In your book, you also devoted quite a bit of time to another metamorphosis that created quite a bit of conflict, was the rise of women reporters. You mentioned how those who became daily newspaper reporters still had trouble gaining acceptance, and one thing that surprised me was that even up until the 1970s, there were restrictions against women reporters at, say, the National Press Club or the Gridiron Club, which are another private organizations of reporters.
It's quite remarkable how long it took to integrate the press galleries. Women had been in the press galleries back in the 19th century, but for the most part, it wasn't until the Second World War, when the men went overseas as either war correspondents or combatants, that jobs opened up for women reporters. And you get people like Helen Thomas and Sarah McClendon coming to Washington and becoming Washington correspondents. When the men come back after the war, a lot of those women lost their jobs. Helen Thomas said the only reason she kept hers was because her hours were so awful and her pay was so low that there wasn't a man who wanted her job at the time. But she just stuck on very doggedly and eventually got to be United Press reporter at the White House. Mrs. Roosevelt had a big impact on women journalists because she held press conferences that only women reporters could go to. So a lot of the news bureaus that had a policy against hiring any women had to hire at least one woman to cover Mrs. Roosevelt's press conferences. Mrs. Kennedy also helped in some respects just because she made so much news by anything that she did that everybody felt they needed to have a reporter, an extra reporter at the White House to do the Kennedy watch, as they called it. But a lot of these women didn't want to do social reporting. They didn't want to do receptions and diplomatic functions and things like that. They wanted to do the hard political reporting. And there was a great deal of resistance in the news organizations to allowing a woman to report the news on television. They didn't think their voices were right, or to even do the hard news that appeared on the front pages of the newspapers. And I chronicle that. I chronicle also the resistance of the National Press Club to admit women and the Gridiron Club, to the point where the women would stand out in the street and picket the dinners in which presidents of the United States and presidential candidates and other politicians would be showing up to speak and to participate, and there would be all of these prominent Washington journalists standing out on the street with signs saying, "Don't go in," because we've been excluded from these organizations.
Why is it that it took so long for the leaders of those organizations, media people, to accept women?
Well, it's certainly about a competition, I suppose, but they were no more advanced in some respects than the rest of society was. It took a long time before people accepted women on untraditional jobs, in a sense. And there was a sense that they were not going to be able to do the serious news reporting, that somehow they were going to be only interested in the frivolous issues. The men were pretty narrow-minded about it at the time, and it took a lot of fighting. The women really had to prove themselves along the way. Ironically, even women at the Washington Post, even though their own publisher was a woman at the time.
Your questions for Donald Ritchie are welcome. 333-9455 in Champaign-Urbana, outside the area, 1-800-222-9455. We welcome your phone calls. And if you have any questions for Donald Ritchie, who's an associate historian with the U.S. Senate and the author of the book Reporting from Washington, The History of the Washington Press Corps. In the book, you also mentioned some of the columnists of the war and post-war era and what kind of sway they held. Are we talking about more sway because of the readership of newspapers and, you know, perhaps the higher share of the market that they had at that time as opposed to columnists today?
It's hard to measure. It's always hard to measure how much influence columnists have. They came onto the scene during the 1930s. And to some degree, when newspapers couldn't afford to have a lot of reporters in Washington, having a Walter Lippmann or a Joseph Alsop or a Drew Pearson on your editorial pages provided a lot of news from Washington with opinion. At the time when newspapers said reporters can't express opinion, they said columnists can. So there was sort of a division of labor in that sense. And a lot of very good reporters moved over into becoming columnists and became columnists for decades, built up enormous reputations, and it had a big sway not only on public opinion but on the policy makers. The people who were at the State Department or the Defense Department or other agencies would read Walter Lippmann in the morning, or they'd read Joseph Alsop, and they were always sort of looking over their shoulder to see how what they were doing was going to play in these columns. So, yes, in the 1960s in particular, the columnists had a tremendous influence in Washington, D.C. I use the Vietnam War and the issue of Walter Lippmann, who was one of the great doves, and Joe Alsop was one of the great hawks in that war, and how they, in a sense, fought out policy on the editorial pages as a way to judge the influence of columnists. I think today there are just so many more columnists. There are so many different avenues in which opinion is expressed on television, on the Internet, as well as on the op-ed pages, that none of the columnists today have quite the same influence that they did, say, in the 1930s or the 1960s.
Let's take a call from Hoopston on line 4. Good afternoon.
Hi, yes, good afternoon. I just joined the conversation, so I apologize if this has already been covered. I've got just three quick, short questions, and I'll hang up and listen. I was intrigued by the points of view on with regards to the women gaining access as reporters. And I'm 50 years old, and I remember vaguely in the early to mid-60s, there was a lady, Nancy Dickerson, who was kind of it as far as lady reporters. Of course, I'm going back 40-some-odd years. And I was just wondering if your guest had any history on her, if she, in fact, was one of the ladies who, you know, trial under fire. And then I remember vaguely there was an older woman with a hat on, and John F. Kennedy was president, and at the press conferences she was famous or infamous for always trying to trip JFK up, and he was giving these really wonderful, probably from today's point of view, sexist answers, but like one-word answers, and he would just get there would be a riotous crowd there and laughter and all that. And then again, in Chicago in the early 60s, there was a lady, Lee Phillip, who had her own kind of newsmakers program out of Chicago. And I just was wondering if she had any sort of Washington connection or, you know, if she was in the vanguard there of the lady reporters. And I'll go ahead and I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
And thanks for your questions.
Well, those are very interesting people. Nancy Dickerson does play a major part in my book. She was a Capitol Hill staff person on the Foreign Relations Committee in the 1950s. When she answered a job, they were looking for a man to be a producer on who knew Capitol Hill for an early radio show on CBS. And she applied, and she got the job, and she became a producer on Face the Nation and some of the other CBS news programs that were going on. She desperately wanted to be on camera, however, with television, not just producing. And so she took all sorts of speech classes, and she finally persuaded Sam Rayburn, the Speaker of the House, to give her an interview, and he would never be interviewed on television. And that convinced Edward R. Murrow and other people at CBS News that she could be a really credible reporter, and they hired her as the first woman correspondent on CBS. There had only been one other woman television correspondent before that nationally, and that was Pauline Frederick, who reported for ABC and then NBC. Nancy Dickerson first worked with CBS, then she went to NBC, and she wound up her career at PBS, and she was just a terrific reporter. She was very close friends with John Kennedy and with Lyndon Johnson. That got her into doors that a lot of other reporters couldn't get into. She had problems, and clearly there were a lot of there was still discrimination against women in terms of her airtime and other things that she was doing. But she fought tooth and nail to get on the air as much as possible. And I found her a fascinating person to study.
And one thing, one aside that I noticed in doing some research on the book, that an interview you gave on C-SPAN a little while back was conducted by her son.
Yes, her son is now Time Magazine's White House correspondent, and he's actually working on a biography of his mother. So that was an interesting connection for me as well. May Craig, the tiny little woman who wore the huge hats, she wore those big hats so she'd be noticed in the crowd of reporters who were all trying to get the president's attention. And the caller is absolutely right that John Kennedy liked to call on May Craig, because whenever the questions would get a little too hot and too pointed, if he called on May Craig, she would sort of get away from the main story that everybody else was following. She was a good reporter, and she had her issues, but she was a bit eccentric on some of these issues, and she would ask some question that Kennedy would give an amusing answer to, would get a huge laugh, would break the tension, and then he could go back to talking about the Bay of Pigs or whatever the other issue was. And there's still wonderful press conferences to watch on the videotapes of Kennedy and how he operated at the time. May Craig had been in Washington since the 1930s herself. Her husband had been a reporter. When he died, she took over his column, and she continued through the late 1960s. Also briefly was a World War II correspondent. Mm-hmm. I'm not as familiar with Lee Phillips, but anybody who's interested in women journalists in general, there's a wonderful website called Women in Journalism that's put out by the National Press Club that's oral histories with about 60 different women journalists, not just all Washington correspondents. There's women from all over the country, all of those interviews are available online, and they really show the fights that women had to put up even outside of Washington just to get some airtime and to get some being taken seriously as a journalist.
Your comments on May Craig remind me of Sarah McLendon late in her career, as having sort of an offbeat kind of question, and then at that point she was pretty much running her own news service.
That's right. Now, Sarah McLendon, back in the Eisenhower years, ran a news service for a series of little newspapers all over Texas. And to advertise her newspapers, every time she'd ask Eisenhower a question, she'd identify herself with a different paper. And finally, Eisenhower, very exasperated, said one day, "Madam, do you get fired every week and hired by another newspaper?" But she was quite a tough reporter. She did not give you an inch. And the very first time I gave a paper on my research, it was at the National Press Club, and Sarah McLendon was the commentator. And she ripped my paper to shreds, and she was very good about what she was doing, but it was a very tough interrogation. And while she was doing it, I thought, geez, she's done this to presidents for years, and now she's doing it to me.
We've only got a couple more minutes here. We can sort of wrap up, but how close is the press corps? There's always been criticism of the Washington press corps, as is Washington in general, being a very within the beltway, insular kind of organization. How has that changed or not changed over time?
I think one thing that's been consistent in Washington is that the higher place your sources, the better the news you report. You need to have inside sources. Otherwise, you're dependent on press releases. And every reporter cultivates people high up in every administration. And that does compromise you. You can't embarrass your sources, and you can't sometimes reveal your sources if they've given you information off the record or in deep background or whatever. But you've got to constantly be going to these people and getting them to talk about what it is the president is planning to do or is likely to do or what this really means. The one thing that the current scandal of the leak from the White House indicates is that the president's top advisors are talking to the press, and that's important, even if they're not necessarily doing it for attribution. And I think that's always complicated the job for the Washington Reporter. It goes way back into the 19th century, and I expect it to continue.
If you were to, or somebody were to write another history of the Washington Press Corps, say 20, 30 years from now, if you look at the press corps today, who might they be writing about? Who is perhaps in the vanguard of today's media?
I would suspect that in 20 years from now, the chapters that you'll see will be very heavily about the Internet. I think that you're going to see a lot more merger of the Internet and radio and television, and it's a sort of so one super media, and a lot of the smaller sites. Fishbowl DC, for instance, is a very interesting site of with young bloggers who are working on it right now. I think that's going to be the sort of the cutting edge of where things are going. But at the same time, I suspect that you're going to see that the major corporations are going to try to figure some way to incorporate what these individuals are doing into something more structured. You'll see a lot of them working for institutions that are affiliated with the New York Times or the Washington Post or Chicago Tribune and things to that effect. So I suspect that's going to be the field where the rookies will be coming up to become the next generation's veterans.
Yet, like you said, a lot of people come from their own offices, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
And
they like to say that they're reporting the news in their bathrobes, essentially. So
they won't be invited to the press corps that or press gallery that way, but
a few of them will, and a lot of the younger bloggers are showing up and are trying to be admitted into the press gallery. But many of them, of course, don't need to be here, even in Washington. And when I ended the book, I discussed Matt Drudge's column, and of course, he was reporting from Los Angeles at the time, and he was breaking stories that were having huge political impact in Washington, D.C. So, in a sense, they've taken the boundaries far beyond the Beltway.
So it's going to make the gallery change in appearance, but also just in the way that news is covered.
Oh, that's true. That's true. And, of course, they also have the International Press Corps here, which is a constantly growing phenomenon of other nations that are desperate to find out what's going on in Washington and what it could possibly mean. And reporters who are trying to explain our form of government to parliamentary systems that really aren't structured anywhere in the same way that we do.
All right. Well, thanks for joining us this afternoon. It's been a very fascinating conversation.
Well, thank you very much.
Donald Ritchie is the Associate Historian of the U.S. Senate, and he's the author of the book Reporting from Washington, The History of the Washington Press Corps, and it came out from Oxford Press. It is 7 and a half minutes right now before 2 o'clock on AM 580. And settlement prices are now in from the Chicago Board of Trade and the Chicago Mercantile Exchange. With those numbers, here's Todd Gleason.
Thank you very much. From the Chicago Board of Trade this afternoon, futures finished the day like this. In the wheat pit, the December contract had a high today of $3.26, the low at $3.20, settlement price at $3.20. They were off 4 cents today. March futures in the wheat, $3.39, the high, the low at $3.33, and a settlement price there at $3.34, down 3¼. May futures in the wheat pit, $3.45, the high, the low at $3.40, settlement price at $3.41, off 3½. In July futures, we're down 3¼ today, at a high of $3.51, a low at $3.46, and a settlement price at $3.47¼. September wheat, $3.56, the high, the low at $3.53, settlement price at $3.53, they were off 3 cents today. From the corn pit, nearby December futures were unchanged as most of the pit managed just some slight gains today. Nearby contract, 207½, the high, the low at 205¾. Harvest month lead option December settled at $2.06¼. Once again, they were unchanged on the day. March futures, 220¼, the high, the low at 218½, a settlement price for the March corn at 219, up a quarter. And the May futures followed suit, up a quarter as well, 227¼, the high, the low at 25½, at a settlement price at $2.26¼ a bushel. July futures at 233¼, the high, the low at 231½. Their settlement, 232½, they were up a half. And September is up 3/4, 239¼, the settlement price there, 239¼, the high as well, and 238½ for that September contract. Once again, they're up 3/4 for the day for next year's September corn contract. Next year's Dease contract, 248½, the high, the low at 247. Red December, 248, the settlement price up a half cent. From the oat pit, nearby September contract, December contract rather, 162½, the high, the low at 155. That September expired last week. 156¾ settlement price for the December oats, down 3½ cents. The March futures were off 2½ at 162½. Soy complex now beans, 578½, the high, the low at 573. Settlement price at $5.76. They were up 4.75 today. January futures up 5.25, 5.87 1/4 the high, the low at 5.81 1/2, and a settlement price at $5.85 1/4. For the January soybeans, they were up 5.25 on the day. March contract, 5.94 1/2 the high, the low at 5.89. Settlement price at 5.92 1/4. They were a nickel higher. The May futures were up 5.25. 5.96 1/2 the settlement price there, with a high of 99 and a low at 94. Soybeans July contracts, $6.03 the high, the low at $5.98. Settlement price at 6.01 1/4. This is the only contract that managed to settle above $6, up 5 cents for the day. August futures, $6 the high, the low at 5.99. Settlement price there at 5.99, and they were up a nickel on the day. October bean meal, 174.80 the high, the low at 173.10. Settlement price at 173.50. They were unchanged. And December bean meal, down 40 at 176.20. October bean oil, 22.84 the high, the low at 22. Settlement price at 22.72. They were up 76. And December futures were up 80 at 22.98, with a high of 23.10, a low at 22.30. During the closing market report this afternoon, we'll talk with Kurt Kimmel of Grainfield Marketing. He's out of Normal, Illinois, and we'll take a look at the futures market with him. Somebody from the Andersons here in Champaign County will join us for the cash grain segment, and we'll talk with the folks at Chesapeake Energy in Chicago to take a look at the agricultural weather for the day. Let's go ahead and do the mercantile exchange numbers for you. Feeder cattle from Chicago at 115.10 settlement price. They were up 22.5 cents today. Had a high price at 115.10, the low at 114.60. Once again, 22.5 higher for the September feeder cattle. October contract at 113.50 high, low at 112.60. Settlement price at 113.45. They're up 52.5 cents. And November cattle, 112.95 the high. November feeder cattle at 111.85 low, and settlement price at $112.82 1/2 a hundredweight. They were up 47.5 cents. From the live cattle pits, the October contract unchanged today, 86.20 the high, the low at $85.60, and a settlement price at $86.07 1/2. 100 weight unchanged. And December futures, 88.50 the high, the low at 87.82 1/2. Settlement price there at 88.40. They were up 12.5 on the day. Lean hogs settled like this, 65.10 on the high, the low at 64.20 for the October contract. Settlement price 64.97 1/2 from the mercantile exchange, 47.5 cents higher. December futures up 32.5. With a high of 62.40, a low at 61.35, and a settlement price for the December lean hogs at $62.30 a hundredweight. February futures, a 63.87 1/2 high, low at 63. Settlement price at 63.77 1/2. They were up 2.5 cents. And the April futures, 2.5 cents higher, 62.47 1/2 the high, the low at 61.80. Settlement price at 62.45. And that's a look at the numbers from the Mercantile Exchange and the Chicago Board of Trade. I'm Todd Gleason. Now here's Tom Rogers.
Thanks, and Todd, we'll take a look at a couple of the outside markets as well, where the Dow is down sharply today, about 104 points at the moment at 10,538. One of the factors in the lower stock markets today are crude oil prices. The price of crude on the New York Mercantile Exchange for October is currently at $67.30 a barrel. That's up $4.30 from last Friday's close.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from First Midwest Bank, serving the banking needs of Illinois' agricultural community with locations in Champaign, Danville, Galesburg, Morris, and McHenry. More information is available from Doug Slayton in Galesburg at 309-341-5003. First Midwest Bank, member FDIC, an equal housing lender.
Thanks to everyone who made the WILL sweepstakes a win-win project. 13 lucky listeners won fabulous prizes.